Hello there. Some plugs to start out. You can follow the show on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. Love to mix it up on there. You can send email to greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. You can also follow the show on SoundCloud. Subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. 5-star reviews are always appreciated. And you can read my blog with many musings on wrestling at section309.com. And now, hit it.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12. Of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and today we're kind of back home for me, anyway. 1991 WWF is kind of like a warm blanket. I watched the whole year. It brings me back to a warm and fuzzy place. It was the year I went to my first wrestling event at the Boston Garden, which was actually a week after this particular superstars we'll be looking at today aired, which was April 13th, 1991. And looking at the lineup for this show, I don't think there's a more 1991 WWF show I could have possibly found, with the Texas Tornado, the Berserker, Tugboat. You have Bret the Hitman Hart in singles action, his first match on television after WrestleMania 7, so here starts that push for the Hitman towards the Intercontinental title. And of course, you have the Ultimate Warrior in the Funeral Parlor, kicking off what I like to call the mini-Attitude Era, or the proto-Attitude Era, because they were doing a lot of weird things in 1991 that they had never done before. I don't know where it came from, whether there was some sort of odd Memphis influence going on there, but they decided to do some angles at that point that were just off the wall compared to everything they had done before. People getting locked in caskets, people getting put in body bags, cobra bites, NWA invasions. It was new, it was different. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. Of course, you also had Earthquake killing a pet snake, which was kind of perhaps on the bad side of the taste scale, and that actually is covered today in an update segment, how that whole thing got started. If I may, I'd like to take a look at last week's show on 1984 Mid-South Wrestling. I had a hell of a time putting that one together. It was definitely out of the usual box for what I thought I might be covering on this show with just WWF and WCW. I kind of want to do more of that going forward. And speaking of going forward, I would have really appreciated it if you're listening to this show and you enjoy it, tell a friend. You know, let's see if we can double the audience in 1 week. I'm not really in this for any sort of monetary gain. This is just kind of a thing for me to do on Saturdays and Sundays, which is when I do most of the recording, to, you know, make my version of Audacity on my computer useful. Something I'm doing right now to avoid going out and exercising. It's 52 degrees out and I really don't feel like running 2 miles. Instead of just sitting there and watching 1991 WWF, I'm here flapping my gums about whatever. So tell a friend, leave a review on iTunes. I guess that helps in terms of getting exposure out there and more listeners. I really don't understand too much about Apple and what they do and why they do the things that they do. Stuff like discontinuing certain products when there's still a demand for it. Although I guess I could, you know, kill Nintendo for that at the same time. Stuff like, oh, we're going to create a new iPod, but we're not going to have any headphone jack for it. I don't know. I feel like I should buy another iPod now so that it's ready to go at the time that my iPod Touch is no longer useful. Now, before I get into a thing about the theme song for this show, which, yes, that was actually the theme for this episode of Superstars, the little patriotic number, as the United States coming off the Gulf War, and of course, it's not like Vince McMahon isn't going to play off patriotism or whatever. By the way, Hulk Hogan is the only guy in the signature at the top of the show, so good to see that the love was getting spread around to some of the other guys on the roster. I do want to look back to episode 7, where I do have to actually issue a couple of corrections or clarifications from that show. Number one, I had mentioned in the opening to the show that it's Bob Backlund throwing a horrible-looking dropkick to Tiger Chung Lee. Upon further review, as they used to say on the NFL replays in the early 1990s, that was actually Eddie Gilbert. It was not Bob Backlund. They kind of just sort of looked alike in terms of body type, but no, that was actually Eddie Gilbert throwing the dropkick. At least I'm pretty sure that it is. The other thing is, in episode 7, Championship Wrestling had a different theme song for 1 week. They weren't using Cruise Control by the Dregs, or the Dixie Dregs, as they were known before that song came out. It was actually Gemini Dream by the Moody Blues, and I was kind of shocked to find out that that was the Moody Blues, because I was unaware that I would ever like a Moody Blues song. I just find most of their stuff to be kind of bland and boring, kind of like Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I'm not really a fan of theirs either. But instead, now I became so hooked on that song, I made it my ringtone on my phone. And yes, during this time period, they used a modified version or whatever of Stars and Stripes Forever as the theme for Superstars. This didn't last particularly long. They went back to the old theme that they would have for the rest of the year. And that's good, because the Stars and Stripes and the whole patriotism and all that business just kind of reminded people how they were exploiting the situation in Iraq and Kuwait to try and make some money off a wrestling angle, and that left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. Not me, though. There's so much 1991 WWF that I want to cover on this show down the road. In fact, somebody has uploaded to YouTube many, many episodes of Superstars from 91, and I think some Wrestling Challenge episodes as well. It's not Richard Land or the Wrestling Collector or any of the other ones. This is somebody who I think is going to get booted off, because they have also uploaded a bunch of Saturday Night Main Events, and I know that those tend to get blocked, but for some reason that got through. And I think once that's found out, the account is probably going to be terminated. We are on the heels of WrestleMania 7, and the announced team on Superstars is personally my second favorite of all Superstars announced teams. Of course, Vince and Jesse is number one. I don't even know how I would factor Bruno into those rankings, because he was there for about a year and a half after Superstars began. But Vince and Jesse is a clear number one for me. But number two is the Vince, Piper, and Savage trio, because I love the way Savage and Piper played off of Vince and kind of played off of each other. And I particularly like the Savage that is announcing in the aftermath of his retirement at WrestleMania 7, because he was still kind of a de facto heel announcer, but he was starting to gradually phase his way back in as a babyface, because, of course, it was unmistakable a babyface turn at WrestleMania 7, reuniting with Elizabeth and all that. It's sort of like when Piper took over for Jesse Ventura in some of those early episodes, and even at SummerSlam 1990, Piper was kind of a middle ground, almost heelish at times, especially if you go back and watch that Hogan versus Earthquake match at SummerSlam 90. He's very much doubting of Hulk Hogan, and you almost think that he's a full-blown heel announcer, but he was kind of straddling that line, and that went away by the end of the year. There was that unfortunate period when the Honky Tonk Man was doing commentary alongside Piper and Vince, and given Piper's incredible disdain for the Honky Tonk Man up to the end of his life, it's really funny to watch those intros with the three of them standing there, and how every time Honky Tonk Man talks, Piper has this look on his face of, can you believe this friggin' guy? I hate this friggin' guy so much. I don't even want to be standing in the same room as him. But yep, there they were together, and thankfully that didn't last too long. We got Vince and Piper in early 1991, and now Savage in what was probably his best announce work of his career. I don't care much for the 1993 Savage at WrestleMania 9 that was just really kind of spewing nonsense, and you would have been better off with Jim Ross and Bobby Heenan by themselves and then put Savage in a freaking match. I mean, why wouldn't you do that at WrestleMania 9? But that's a whole other ball of wax. So, a lot to get to here. So let's get cracking, shall we?
That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. Losing my religion. Trying to keep up with you. And I don't know if I can do it.
For our opening contest, I think I owe a mea culpa to you, oh fine listener, because in episode 5, I had mentioned that the Black Knight was a wrestler by the name of Casey Thompson, and then went into a long and detailed bio of his career where he played Pesticide Pete down in a Florida promotion. Although now, it seems I'm losing a little faith in Cage Match and Wrestling Data and all the sites that I've been using for this sort of research, because there is apparently a second Black Knight who is taking on the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich. And his name is Billy Anderson, and he looks very familiar, and he's listed for all sorts of Superstars tapings through the late 80s and into the early 90s. As a matter of fact, once you get to 1993, he's no longer the Black Knight. He becomes the White Shadow, or White Shadow. And I don't know if he had clearance from Bruce Paltrow or Ken Howard to use that name, but I'm sure it appealed to Bill Simmons and all those people of that age. Really, not too much to add about him. Other than the fact that I probably should have been able to tell which Black Knight was which based on body type. But that's not so important, because what we should be focused on here is the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich. And I was actually very surprised to hear them refer to him as Kerry Von Erich. The difference between Kerry and, say, a Davy Boy Smith is the Von Erich name still had some value in 1991, despite all the tragedy that had already taken place, and there was still much more of that to come. It's so depressing to even think about that I really don't even want to rehash it unless, you know, I'm just sort of touching upon it here. But I do want to rewind back to 1984, when Kerry was on top of the world as the NWA World Champion for about 18 days. It was a purposely short reign because the NWA wanted to get the title back on Ric Flair before a scheduled match with Ricky Steamboat on a Night of Champion card in late May of 84. Vince McMahon wanted the Von Erichs into his fold very badly in 1984, at a time when he was not acknowledging other promotions anymore, since he had already used the trick of putting guys on his All-American show to expose them to his audience and then later stealing them and signing them for himself. The only other promotion that he would even acknowledge was the Von Erichs in World Class. And this was done in a couple of ways. When David Von Erich passed away in February 1984, they actually acknowledged it on television and tolled the bell for him at the beginning of the championship wrestling show, which was fairly unusual. You didn't have as many wrestler deaths back then, particularly an active competitor. And it's just really strange at a time when David Von Erich was never in the WWF full-time, they took the time to actually acknowledge his death. And it's generally accepted that David probably would have become the NWA champion in place of Kerry, and that Kerry really won it in that May of 84 spot in Dallas, Texas, at Texas Stadium, actually Irving, Texas, but it's all semantics, because David had passed away. David was a very well-rounded wrestler. He could work face and heel, which I guess was kind of a knock on Kerry. Kerry was a babyface for pretty much the entirety of his big run there. In the new WWF magazine in 1984, there was even a profile on the Von Erichs. And if you fast forward 2-3 years, that seems incredibly strange in retrospect, because when you think of WWF magazine, you think of it as the ultimate house organ, the Pravda, if you will, of Vince's fiefdom. And there they are promoting these guys in Texas who are in a completely different federation or whatever. And it was Vince's hope that he would always have a working agreement with Fritz Von Erich. And he alluded to it in public on at least one occasion, but that just never ended up happening for whatever reason. The Von Erich boys wanted to stay in Texas. And when Vince finally got a hold of Kerry Von Erich in 1990, it was way too late. It's kind of like signing Babe Ruth in 1935. It's still Babe Ruth, and I don't mean to compare Kerry Von Erich to Babe Ruth, but it was just too much stuff had happened, and he was just too far gone at that point. It had been more than 4 years since his motorcycle accident. The big secret of the time was that Kerry lost his right foot in the accident, or more accurately, he had the foot after the accident and then tried to walk on it way too soon, and that is what resulted in it being amputated. And of course, he was never the same guy in the ring after that point. And in fact, there's an incident in 1988 where the foot came off in a match against Colonel De Beers, which shocked the hell out of everybody, to say the least. But it was still mostly a secret from the viewing public. And as a result of that accident, Kerry ended up on a host of painkillers and whatnot, and it was kind of a spiral for him. And he did stay in Texas working for his dad and others as it became the USWA from World Class up into 1990. So he jumps into WWF July of 1990, and something just didn't seem right the entire time he was there. Even if you take his Intercontinental Championship match at SummerSlam 1990, it seems really strange that the match is only 5 minutes and Kerry, for lack of a better term, definitely looked off. And it was not a long run. He would lose the title to Mr. Perfect just before the Survivor Series. And one of the cool moments of the Tornado's run in WWF is the team that he was on at Survivor Series 1990, which was a assortment of various, quote, warriors. And it was called that because the Ultimate Warrior was the captain of the team. But the other members of the team were the Legion of Doom, who of course commonly known as the Road Warriors in the AWA and in Jim Crockett Promotions before that, and Kerry Von Erich, who was billed as the Modern Day Warrior in his early days in Texas and whatnot. So it was kind of cool, and also fun to see the Ultimate Warrior side by side with Kerry, who of course they were together in Texas, the Warrior as the Dingo Warrior, although Kerry was kind of on the hiatus at that point because of the accident. And I want to make something perfectly clear that even though I was, of course, a, quote, dumb 12-year-old at the time and whatever, I never for one second believed that whole Ultimate Warrior is Kerry Von Erich crap that was being fed around 1992. When the Warrior came running out at WrestleMania 8, a lot of people said, oh, well, the Ultimate Warrior died, and then he was replaced by Kerry Von Erich. And it was so stupid that I couldn't even have a conversation about that. I would just sort of roll my eyes, and because there was no way that I was ever going to get through to somebody by saying, no, that's the same Ultimate Warrior. He's just a little smaller, or as I noticed more than his smaller physique, his hair was all screwed up. His hair was very different when he returned. It was like all weird and short. I don't know. Perhaps I could rank Ultimate Warrior hairdos throughout the years. Of course, he's coming up later in the funeral parlor. And the Warrior hair in 91 was probably the best hair, at least in my opinion. If you're going to have the mullet look, at least go with that. I'm not talking about Kerry here, and neither is the announce team, as Vince is really concerned about who the Black Knight is. And it's just really strange because he's just, you know, literally this faceless guy. Pat Piper says he thinks it's Pat Patterson, and Vince kind of says he retired years ago under his breath. Of course, Patterson actually had matches up through about 1987. He had matches with Brutus Beefcake in Montreal. They had a little Montreal-only angle going on there. They asked Macho Man who he thinks the Black Knight is, and Macho just kind of, it's really strange. He hems and haws. He then does play-by-play for a second, which makes Vince really mad, and then he proclaims, in all seriousness, that he thinks it is Andre the Giant.
Okay, okay, a little guessing game here.
Yep.
All right, Macho Man Randy Savage, you go first.
Okay, I think it's
Pat Patterson.
Years ago.
Okay.
Kerry Von Erich just got pushed against the ropes in the Black Knight.
Wait a minute. I'm supposed to be doing the commentary.
That's right, you are.
You were asked a question who the Black Knight was.
Uh-huh, and I forgot to give the answer, but I'm right on time now. Lately, here I am.
Yeah, you are on
time.
Thank
you very much. I appreciate that.
We're not talking taxes, Macho Man. Who do you figure the Black Knight is? I mean, you have fought just about everybody there is.
Andre the Giant.
Now, it's funny that he mentions Andre, as he was starting to appear on television once again. He did appear at WrestleMania 7, kind of helping out the Big Boss Man a little bit in his match against Mr. Perfect. And Andre would appear on television in the next couple of weeks, having managers come to him and ask. These were just comedic skits where Mr. Fuji, Sensational Sherry would come to him and say, I want to be your manager. And then you'd have these bizarre results, like Mr. Fuji's face ends up in a cake. Sherry gets bent over a bar and spanked. It's really, really weird. But Andre, of course, never returned other than a one-off match in Europe. And Kerry picks up the win here with the discus punch, a move that I never particularly cared for and always wondered in Jesse Ventura fashion how the closed fist could possibly be legal there. His other hold, the Iron Claw, not exactly one that I like either, but I mean, at least it was, you know, somewhat exciting. You can get a pin or a submission out of it. Kerry's moveset, not the most dynamic in the world, which is probably why he was never really one of my favorites growing up. The other thing about Kerry that would drive me nuts, at least during his WWF run, is his music. And this was a time when everybody had to have music, especially baby faces. And there were some holdouts there for a long time. Like Hacksaw Jim Duggan, for a very long time, had no theme music. He would just sort of come out and hold the 2x4 up high. And then eventually he got the generic Big John Studd music that was repackaged and sped up and reworked a little bit. But Tornado's music, I hate it so much. It is basically like the store brand cola of WWF music. It's just this generic guitar riff that has no soul or any. It's the most soulless piece of crap I've ever heard. I just hate it so much. And I'm probably alone here, but I've thought this for a quarter of a century. And I've just got to get it out there that the Texas Tornado's music just drives me absolutely insane. But he picks up the win here over the Black Knight. I play this to illustrate just how plain and generic this is, in case you'd forgotten what the Tornado's theme music sounded like. This is during an era where you had Jim Johnson coming up with a lot of good stuff, and you still had Jimmy Hart there coming up with all those fun little ditties like the Rougeau theme song and this and that kind of stuff. But for Kerry Von Erich, we get this. We get store brand cola, which, why did it drive me so nuts to hear that music? Probably because the other guys had such great theme music. Now, of course, you know, it was Rick Derringer helping out there. You had Coco Beware actually singing his own song, first Pile Driver, and then Everybody Get Up, Everybody Get Down. But not a fan of the Tornado's theme music, although I think I've made that perfectly clear by now. Oh, that's some quality middle school dance music got there. But right now we're at the update desk with Gene Okerlund, and he takes us back to the previous week's superstars, where there was an incident probably due to the timing of it all. I always love when stuff like this would happen. It probably most famously happened with the Sergeant Slaughter Iron Sheik feud in 1984. And let me explain that. So what we have here is Jake the Snake had prevailed in his match, and he had the snake around his neck, and they just hit the music for Earthquake to come out for his match. And so Earthquake's on his way to the ring at the same time that Jake is heading back up the aisle. And Earthquake, they kind of have a standoff there, because Earthquake is not happy about seeing the snake there. Of course, they've done this a million times by now. Jake has a snake, and the other guy's afraid of it. Thankfully, this would be the last time that Jake would kind of pull this trick, because it was getting a little tired at this point. You had it with Andre and, you know, many others. I mean, the heels would be terrified of the snake. And Earthquake pulls Jimmy Hart in the way and just kind of keeps pedaling backwards. He knocks over a barricade at one point to get out of there. And honestly, when you look at it, Jake is a friggin' bully here. There's no two ways about it. Whoever timed it screwed it up so that Earthquake is now heading to the ring as this guy holding a giant python is on his way to the back. And there's no reason for Jake to have any problem with Earthquake. He just holds up the snake at him to screw with him. And given what happened in this storyline a couple of weeks later, where Earthquake kills Damien in the bag by performing the Earthquake splash on the bag, in reality some hamburger meat in a tube sock or, you know, pantyhose or whatever, Jake kind of had what was coming to him. And I know that this is kind of reverse psychology or whatever. It's kind of like that thing where, oh, Daniel was the actual bully in The Karate Kid. And I am willing to hear the case on that at some point. But Earthquake kind of, you know, was standing up to a bully here. And this was kind of a subtle way of turning Jake ever so slightly towards the dark side, as it were. He gets a new snake called Lucifer. Lucifer being, you know, the name of the devil. And then you have Jake training the Ultimate Warrior in those vignettes before finally having the snake bite him. And then you have the don't trust a snake bit, you know, trust me, trust me, trust me. So if you go back, this Earthquake thing, really, I consider kind of the beginning of Jake's heel turn. Not because he's being a bully, although by any objective standard he is, but think about it. A year from this moment, Jake is a heel on his way out the door, and Earthquake is a babyface in the natural disasters. It's kind of funny when you think about it. Now for a moment that I've feared for a while. When I set out to do this podcast, I wondered to myself, what is going to happen when I have to talk about somebody like the Berserker for a second or third time? And he was covered in episode 5, appearing on Wrestling Challenge in January of 1992, and I said my piece on the Berserker. Stuff like, well, maybe it would have turned into a Spam-a-lot gimmick had he been around now. Thing about the furry boots. He was originally known as the Viking, billed from Iceland. What can I possibly say about him now? Well, I can't say anything about his opponent, Jim Colep, because he made two appearances in the WWF. This one, and then the one the next night at the Challenge tapings in Reno, Nevada. I was hoping that maybe I could say that this was the first Berserker match after the changeover from the Viking, but no, in fact, it was the second one, because he had taped one earlier in March, about 2 weeks before WrestleMania, where he faced a guy by the name of John Allen, and that appeared on Superstars, but on Primetime Wrestling couple of nights after WrestleMania 7. So this is the second televised Berserker match. So just feel the history. Now, speaking of history, why would you change the name from the Viking to the Berserker? I mean, he had the Viking hat from Spamalot or whatever. Why would you change it to the Berserker? I'm thinking that maybe the ultra litigious and happy lawyers from the National Football League might not have liked him being called the Viking. John Nord, of course, from the great state of Minnesota. I think that it was probably one of those things where, oh, Berserker sounds like more of a fun name or whatever. So I dug into it deeper, as I am wont to do, and I found out the origin, the etymology, is that the correct word, for the term Berserker. And it is from Norse legend, and the word Berserker is to represent champion Norse warriors, reported in Icelandic literature to fight in trance-like fury. And that makes perfect sense with the standing there with his hand and going, huss, huss, huss. So, you know, I have not read my full share of Icelandic literature. I've had some issues with the language in the past. It can be a little difficult to read, but I try my best here. Let me give you a little bit more background on berserkers themselves. In battle, the berserkers were subject to fits of frenzy. They would howl like wild beasts, foamed at the mouth, and gnawed the iron rim of their shields. And of course, you saw Berserker there, had the sword and the shield. According to belief, during these fits, they were immune to steel and fire, and made great havoc in the ranks of the enemy. When the fever abated, they were weak and tame. Accounts can be found in the sagas. This expression berserk most likely arose from their reputed habit of wearing a kind of shirt or coke, a cirque, made from the pelt of a bear, burr, during battle. The bear was one of the animals representing Odin, and by wearing such a pelt, the warriors sought to gain the strength of a bear and the favor of Odin. So clearly we've established now that Vince McMahon, Pat Patterson, that whole gang, they were sitting around the pool reading Nordic literature and mythology and all that Picayune Michigas, and that was how they came up with the Berserker gimmick. So in reality, it is a well-thought-out gimmick, and I will hear no arguments about the Berserker being wrestle crap or anything like that. So that begs the question now, why did this gimmick not work in the end? Was it just a case of Mr. Fuji being, well, he's kind of in that in-between period between the whole demolition thing and before he got Yokozuna, and Mr. Fuji was pretty useless during that time. He would just kind of stare at the Berserker as he would come to the ropes and say something to him. Is it the fact that Nord himself was a little flaky and maybe wrestling wasn't his first priority because he had other interests? Was he not focused enough on becoming a big star? That's a possibility too. I mean, this is just a normal match here, except for the fact that the referee, when Berserker throws the guy out of the ring like his usual, he administers the fastest 10 count in the history of professional wrestling. He just fly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Referee, hey, can you do the, you know, tag football 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, you know, something like that. And after he counts the guy out, Berserker does a pescado plancha. You know, I'm not really much of a name of moves guy. That's why I don't do a lot of play-by-play here on the show. Berserker just kind of goes up over the ropes and then lands on the guy for good measure. So at least it gives a logical reason for why he would throw the guy out of the ring and win by countout. Of course, anybody who had a thought would, you know, see him win all of his matches like that and say, how could he possibly win a title? Well, he did pin guys too, like at the first house show I went to, where apparently he pinned Tugboat in a match I don't remember anything about. But I do think that if John Nord was around right now, I think he would have a much better career because he seems like one of those guys who would not be in WWE. He might have been there, you know, years before and people know who he is. But I think he's one of those guys that would travel around the indies and just kind of, you know, take a big paycheck whenever he could as like the big heavy who would come in and do cool moves because he was a big agile guy and all that. So I'm actually suggesting that John Nord and the Berserker of all things were ahead of its time and well thought out. So that's probably the hottest take you'll get from me here today.
Best way to describe the Berserker style in the ring is utter chaos. And one thing an opponent can expect from the wild newcomer is the unexpected, as several individuals have already fallen victim to his rather unusual technique.
I don't know where they throw it to the great Sean Mooney at the event center, or more accurately, they don't even really throw it to him. It just kind of switches to him. And Mooney, just so underrated in retrospect, just... It almost makes it seem like he came up with that whole line about the Berserker on the fly, like he had been sitting there, and he's a guy who's in the batter's box, and he's sitting on a 101-mile-an-hour fastball, and he has to turn on it, and he's always got one quip for, like, the Berserker or whatever. Gene Okerlund rightfully gets a lot of love, but Sean Mooney was really, really excellent in his 4 or 5 years there. And if you want to hear more from Sean Mooney, I recommend... He recently did an interview with the Our Vantage Point, the retro wrestling podcast, which is also on SoundCloud. And I know that on my page, I believe I liked that, so it should show up on the side of my page. But check out that podcast. It's 45 minutes of audio gold with Sean Mooney, who certainly has the right attitude about his days in the WWF, and he tells all sorts of great stories. It's the way I wish that, you know, people from that era would be, rather than the old Tony Schiavone, you know, dig a hole and get the hell away from these people. As long as you're respectful towards them. I do remember Sean Mooney shortly after his time working at WBZ Channel 4 here in Boston, and just being so taken aback by, you know, after seeing him hosting these event centers for years and years, and then all of a sudden he's telling me about a fire in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And it's just a startling change. You're expecting him to throw it to Virgil out in the field, but it's a pretty amazing transition that he made, and that's not easy. And he talks about getting his start on the OVP podcast interview, and It's really, man, he worked his ass off for the entire time that he was there. It to sit in that damn studio and do 90 event centers, and then, you know, he said that Howard Finkel would come by and say, "Oh, there's a change," and then he would have done 10 or 15 of them, and he'd have to do them all over again. So, Sean Mooney, nothing but love for him in the event center, and I got really excited because I thought, ooh. The first house show I went to is a week after this, so maybe I'm going to get to hear promos, you know, say from the Warlord against for his upcoming match against Kerry Von Erich, or from Tugboat for his match against the Berserker. But no, this is really weird. It's an event center, and it's all the event centers on this show have to do with no event. They're just random promos there. So it's like Hacksaw Jim Duggan talking about how he loves America and doesn't know how to pronounce Norman Schwarzkopf's name, which just tells me that Duggan doesn't watch the news or CNN, because the guy's name was said aloud many, many times. The house show that I went to was really weird when I look at the results of it, because Hogan and Piper both lost on that show. They didn't get pinned. Hogan got DQ'd. They were doing the bit where he would get caught with the chair after Slaughter had used it, and the ref would wake up and all that. They did the exact same match at Madison Square Garden 2 nights later, which is on the network, I believe, April 22nd, 1991. It may also be on YouTube as well. Piper lost to Ted DiBiase due to a referee stoppage because, as you see on Superstars, he's got a crutch from his motorcycle accident. And Piper was, you know, in the ring, and they would stop the matches rather than have him get pinned or have DiBiase get pinned. It was a pretty good finish there. And me being a stupid, well, I guess I was still 11 at that point, I brought a sign to a house show. And that kind of just, you know, I don't think it had quite sunk in with me that they had stopped filming the Boston Garden shows 2 years before. Maybe I was hoping that they would start doing them again, because I loved watching those Boston Garden shows on NESN for like the small window after I had started watching and before they actually stopped. And my favorite part of the WWF on NESN, well, actually there's a couple things that I really love. Number one, on my YouTube page, I have Sean McDonough, who, of course, now the lead play-by-play announcer for NFL Monday Night Football. He's reading the promo for the next WWF on NESN show, which was the December 1987 house show, featuring a main event of the Honky Tonk Man defending the Intercontinental title against Macho Man Randy Savage. You have Bam Bam Bigelow versus King Kong Bundy. The other reason to watch that Boston Garden house show is it's a very rare instance of the broadcast team of Gorilla Monsoon and Nick Bockwinkel. And I really like Bockwinkel as the color guy on the house shows where he was used. There's only a handful of shows. There's an MSG show, there's that Garden show, and then there's a couple, I think, in Hamilton, Ontario, where Bockwinkel was on the call. It's quite a change from, you know, say, Bruno Sammartino not saying anything on Superstars during that time period. The other thing about the WWF on NESN that I loved was the opening theme song, which was just this incredibly epic song. And I, you know what? I got to dig this up and play it right now. Well, apologies for the audio here. It really builds up to a crescendo here. You get the best use of string instruments until Nakamura would come along 30 years later. Unfortunately, that was kind of the alternate one where they didn't have like the big ending where it went da-na-na-na-na-na-na. Yeah, I love those Boston Garden shows, and I wish, just put them on the network, just full, you know what, we don't even need them on the network, because we have it on YouTube, we have Richard Land, we have the Wrestling Collector, and that entire theme song just makes me want to run through a wall. That gets me fired up like nobody's business. And yeah, I was pretty fired up for that house show, but like I said, all the heels were going over, which was very strange for 1991 WWF. You had Mr. Perfect beating the British Bulldog clean for the Intercontinental title, and although they did send us home happy with the Rockers beating the Orient Express to close the show. It was a matinee show at the Boston Garden, and they actually ran that night at the Philadelphia Spectrum, so those, a lot of the guys on that card, such as Hogan and Slaughter, had double duty. And I want to play the Mr. Perfect promo from the Event Center here, because he's with Heenan. And it's the last days of the Perfect and Heenan combo, before he would hand the keys over to Coach John Tolos, which, oh dear God. And that team there, it just makes me wish that Perfect had been put in the Heenan family in 1989, because he was a perfect fit there. He was a perfect complement to Ravishing Rick Rude, who is an example of a guy who didn't like having Bobby Heenan as his manager. Kind of a rare example there. But at this time, Perfect got the Intercontinental title, and he's doing that thing where he's doing the I am what I say I am, but with a neat little twist at the end.
What a treat for you humanoids at home. The World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental Champion.
You know, Bobby, you've been around the World Wrestling Federation for a long time. You've seen them come, you've seen them go, you've seen big ones, you've seen small ones. But now, come on, be honest with me. Who is the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time?
Mr. Perfect. How was that? Didn't mean to take so long.
No, it didn't. You know why it doesn't take him long to say Mr. Perfect? Because what all you people don't realize is what a great athlete I really am. And I am what I say I am. And I say I'm... You all said it. You all know it, and you all gotta believe it. Because I am perfect in every way.
He said it. I heard him.
Bobby the Banter Heenan on that one there. For the next bout, we have two guys from established wrestling families and two guys who made a mark at one point or another in Stampede Wrestling. We're talking Bret the Hitman Hart versus Barry O. Barry O? Yes, for those who may not know, Barry O, the O in Barry O doesn't stand for the number of wins he has, because he would pick up wins in 85 and 86 as kind of the opening match on house shows from time to time. He even won a title in one of the regional promotions back in 1979. Barry O is Barry Orton, and he is the uncle of Randy Orton, and thus the brother of Ace Cowboy Bob Orton, and of course the son of Bob Orton Sr. So you have a pretty legendary wrestling family there, and Barry O, kind of an odd fit. He was obviously, you know, had a career in wrestling, but I don't know how much he was really committed to that. I think he wanted to be an actor. He was merely an okay hand in the ring and not the great worker that Cowboy Bob was and that people allege Randy Orton to be. I don't know. I find him a little boring, although... Can I take an opportunity to say this, and maybe it'll hurt my credibility on this show, I have no idea. I actually mildly enjoyed the House of Horrors match at that pay-per-view this past Sunday. I don't even remember what the pay-per-view was called, but at least I'm just grateful for WWE trying something different for a change instead of doing the same guy hits finisher and then... when the guy kicks out, he looks up and then he gets bug-eyed and is all shocked that somebody kicked out of a finisher, as if, you know, that hadn't happened seven times earlier on the card. Anyway, I digress here. Barry O, as I said, he was kind of a enhancement guy, but he was one of those kind of like Leaping Lanny Poffo, where he would be there and say, let's say you put him in a tag match on television, he would be the guy that doesn't get pinned. So he would be tagged with, say, a Mario Mancini, and then Mario Mancini would eat the pin. He's known for a couple of things that are kind of difficult to talk about. He had a car accident on April 28th, 1987, and a passenger, a female passenger in his car, Sherry Jo Bennett, a woman not his wife, was killed in the incident, and he was actually hospitalized and then arrested in the hospital for that. And the WWF let him go at that point because he had some legal issues to straighten out. And what he did in 1987 was he went up to Canada and portrayed a character called the Zodiac. Now, not to be confused with the Brutus Beefcake Zodiac in WCW, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. But he would wear this mask, and it got over pretty good in Stampede in 1987. And he was working with Jason the Terrible, played by Carl Moffat. And what this is just kind of sums up Barry O's career in a nutshell. Eventually, it comes down to it, and he gets unmasked. And the announcer, probably Ed Whalen, because Ed Whalen had this habit of just crapping on stuff, he gets unmasked and just says, "I don't know who that is," which is always the danger of the unmasking angle. If you're going to unmask the guy, you know, there's a Mexican tradition of that. But, you know, if you make that an issue and it's a guy that nobody knows, well, it's probably going to go over like a fart in church, and nobody really wants that. The other thing that Barry O is known for is his kind of tangential role as a witness in the 1992 WWF sex scandal that centered around Terry Garvin, or at least Barry O's testimony did. He testified to a 1978 incident where he was riding in a car with Terry Garvin, and I don't understand how this happens. It's just really bizarre. Apparently, what Barry O says is that Terry Garvin kept offering to perform oral sex on Barry, and Barry kept turning him down. And he kind of, you know, made this testimony to support some of the other allegations against Terry Garvin in this case. And he appeared on that infamous episode of the Phil Donahue Show, where Vince was on there, and you got, I think, Dr. D, David Schultz was on there. That's something I should probably watch. I remember watching a little bit of it on YouTube about 3 years ago, but I don't think I sat through the entire thing. So that's Barry O. He came back 1991, and this is pretty much the end of his run in the WWF. You wouldn't see him too much longer after this. But this was just the beginning for Bret the Hitman Hart and his singles push for real this time. Really, Bret, we are actually going to push you this time. Neidhart has been shuffled off into the Wrestling Challenge broadcast booth, which, as I said, adding a third guy to the Heenan Monsoon team, not the greatest in the world. But at least it allowed Bret to finally blossom as a singles star. They started him off with the Barbarian, and that was his first kind of, you know, feud. And Bret and the Barbarian was actually the first match I saw at that house show in 1991, and they fought to a draw. And of course, the idea is to build him up to be the challenger to Mr. Perfect by SummerSlam, and it's something that they definitely accomplished, and they accomplished very well. Sometimes Bret squash matches, you know, he fits in quite a bit in 3 minutes, and he would give something to the opponent. I don't know if it was, you know, a thank you to Barry O for, you know, making Stampede Wrestling mildly hot back in 87 or what was going on. But Barry O gets in a little bit of offense here. He misses a knee off the ropes. It's kind of startling to see the enhancement guy doing a move off the ropes, but he misses that. Bret goes for an O'Connor roll and only gets two. And that's something that you don't see very often, is the job guy on the Saturday morning show kicking out at any point. Usually you just don't see a pin until, you know, star wrestler hits his finish. Vince McMahon tells us, apropos of nothing in the middle of this, that Brutus Beefcake is coming back, and he's opening his own barber shop that weekend. Now, I remember watching this episode at the time, and I was a big Brutus Beefcake fan in 89 and 90, and he was the friend of Hogan and all that. And when I heard this watching, I actually remember what I was thinking. I was like, why is Vince McMahon telling us that Brutus Beefcake is opening a barbershop? Now, I thought it was a physical barbershop because, you know, I was stupid and probably believed that gimmicks were real. Like, I thought, you know, if it had been years later, I would have thought, oh, I call Duke Drosy, you know, to come pick up my trash, or I call T.L. Hopper because I got a clog, you know, in my sink and I need, you know, one of those snake things or whatever, and I need professional help. I don't know. I must have been just really, really dumb. So Beefcake is opening a barbershop, and he just kind of leaves it at that. And Piper and Macho Man both basically call Beefcake an idiot, which is really kind of funny. But in fact, it was actually the debut of the Barbershop Talk segment, kind of the B talk show behind the Funeral Parlor, and was something that was always on Wrestling Challenge. And I covered one barbershop famously in episode 5, where the Rockers wrecked the set a little bit, or more accurately, Sean did. Unless you believe Marty, you know, dove through the window in an act of cowardice to get away. But yeah, so this same weekend, Beefcake opens the Barbershop Talk Show segment. So that's what he's getting at there. This match is also historic, and I have to go off on this for a little bit because it is the debut of the Sharpshooter as Bret Hart's finishing maneuver. And this narrative of Bret Hart is always that he's been doing the Sharpshooter since birth. I never once saw him do that move as a single wrestler or even in the Hart Foundation tag team before 1991. And this is my challenge to you. If you can find an instance of Bret Hart, let's cut it off at WrestleMania 7. Before WrestleMania 7, doing the sharpshooter in any match, please let me know, because I don't think it existed. In fact, the only time I can remember the sharpshooter or something thereabouts on WWF programming was Ronnie Garvin, I believe, beat Greg the Hammer Valentine in a submission match at Royal Rumble 1990 with the move. And I also recall Terry Taylor in a pre-Red Rooster state where he hadn't been settled with that, using the move to win some early matches on TV. So if you can find a Bret Hart match prior to 1991 where he uses the sharpshooter, can we stop this nonsense that he had it all along? But they did a good job of presenting it like he was doing that move all along, because Bret was using the pile driver, and he would make that pile driver look good. He would do it in kind of an Orndorff sort of way. He would really make it look stiff, but, you know, not hurt anybody. You know, it's not like a Hart to injure somebody severely with a pile driver, right? Yeah. So we're gonna push you, Bret. We swear. We're not gonna screw you, Bret, okay? Trust me. Right now we have the end of Ricky Itachi as a jobber on WWF television. He's teaming up with Steven DeLeon to take on the new World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, the Nasty Boys. Just a quick word about Ricky Itachi. I kind of like his look. You know, yeah, he was never going to win a match and never came close to winning a match, but he kind of looked like a lesser Pat Tanaka. Definitely not as talented as Pat Tanaka, but he had kind of a similar look there. The most famous thing that I remember Ricky Itachi from is he lost a match to Greg the Hammer Valentine in summer of 1988. And they did that thing like kind of what we had with Jake Roberts and Earthquake, where superstar Billy Graham and the Rock Don Morocco come down for their match. And Valentine's still in the ring, and he puts Itachi in the figure four again. And what happens is that they go to help Morocco and Graham, go to help Itachi. And what Jimmy Hart does is he spits in Morocco's face. Morocco chases Jimmy Hart backstage. You have Graham out there with his cane, can barely move. And Valentine attacks him from behind and locks him in the figure four. And, of course, it's Graham in any sort of move, so they make it like he's going to be friggin' crippled for life and not going to be able to move. And that kind of wrote off superstar Billy Graham as a manager. So, really, I guess it was not about Ricky Itachi. It was about Ricky Itachi losing and then the angle afterwards. But, you know, some fond memories of him, anyway. The Nasty Boys, who might be the house tag team for this particular podcast, and let me explain why. I don't know if they properly attributed their hometown here, if Finkel did that, because both guys are actually from Allentown, Pennsylvania. I don't know if they went to any of the WWF tapings between 1978 and 1984. It feels like that they might have stood out as rowdy sorts of dudes, but the Nasty Boys, when they won the tag team titles at WrestleMania 7 and up to SummerSlam, it felt like they were on either Superstars or Challenge every single week. And it was a hell of a run for them. And they came in December of 1990 in one of the classic WCW stories ever. They were in WCW. They had a great match with the Steiner Brothers at Halloween Havoc 1990. And somebody in the WWF office must have seen it, because we all know Vince definitely wasn't watching, because he doesn't watch anything except for his own stuff. And it was probably brought to the attention of somewhere along that food chain, and it came out that the Nasty Boys did not have contracts in WCW. So they're allowed to go on pay-per-view, have this great match, and they're unsigned, and they turn up in the WWF in December. By February, they are winning a battle royal to determine the number one contenders to the Hart Foundation due to some shenanigans involving Power and Glory helping to eliminate the Legion of Doom. One other thing I should mention is that Brian Knobbs was actually one of the final three people in the 1991 Royal Rumble. It's one of my favorite early Royal Rumble foibles, where you have one half of this guy who is in a new tag team, and he's there at the Royal Rumble at the end. Now, to be more precise, the Nasty Boys are not from Allentown proper. They're actually from the Whitehall Township, which is really, I guess, just kind of next to Allentown. It's all semantics. I mean, as I mentioned in an earlier episode, I dated a girl from the area, so I kind of know the names of all the places. There's some really cool names. Of course, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, being one of my favorite in that area, Eastern Pennsylvania. But I always liked the Nasty Boys style. They were very different. You have a lot of colorful tag teams wearing these multicolored outfits at the time. And here you got these brawlers who got like the fake spray paint on their outfit. They're wearing all black before the all black look in the 90s kind of became a thing. They were really good brawlers. Now, I will grant that they were sloppy as hell. And that's what Mick Foley has said in his book, is that they were really sloppy, but they were really good as brawlers. And the sloppiness, I guess, would cause them some problems down the road. You had the little shoot with Scott Hall in 1996 WCW, where Sags thought that Hall had hit him in an untoward way, but it was actually Kevin Nash when they went back and looked at the film of it. But they did have some fantastic brawls in WCW, and they were centered around, of course, surprise, surprise, Mick Foley as Cactus Jack, the many, many time, I don't know how many times he won the Best Brawler Award. I guess it's called the Bruiser Brody Award with the Wrestling Observer News, Wrestling Observer Awards at the end of the year. And they had I don't know if it was a concession stand brawl. It was at Spring Stampede 1994. That match is just a really fun brawl to watch. You got people slipping on. Maybe that was Uncensored 1995. There's a lot of good Nasty Boys stuff in 94 and 95 WCW. But their WWF stuff, I feel like they really stood out. They were a little too gross, but at least their heels being gross and not baby faces being gross like the Bushwhackers. So they're accomplishing the goal that they're setting out to do with like the pit stop and all that. And I'm wondering, how many times after they introduced that pit stop on WWF television did a kid on a playground in an elementary school somewhere in the United States or anywhere in the world that had WWF television had some kid have his, you know, head shoved into another kid's armpit in a fit of bullying? You know, be a star, kids, be a star. Probably, I guess JBL wouldn't have been in elementary school then, but, you know, there are a lot of little JBLs out there, and I've seen it myself. Another critique of their run here is the idea that maybe Power and Glory should have gotten that run instead of the Nasty Boys. And it's just one of those things where the Nasty Boys became available and they were a little bit better choice for the role than Power and Glory were. I think just, even if it was just incremental, I just feel like it fit a little bit better. Plus, I don't know if there were issues with Paul Roma backstage. I had mentioned he did an interview on Steve Austin's podcast. It's a two-parter, and it's well worth listening to. I don't know if he had some issues with the people backstage, but he had been there for a while, and Hercules had been there for a while. So while they had the cool finisher, you know, the Nasty Boys had some cool stuff in their own right. They kind of a similar finisher with a power slam and then the elbow by Sags off the ropes finishes this match, and that was actually their finisher. And like I said, I feel like I saw that same thing every single Saturday or Sunday on Superstars or Challenge all the time with the Nasty Boys. Felt like they were a part of my life in 1991. They, of course, would stick around into 1992 and would eventually turn babyface. And that's another, I think that the Nasty Boys also work as, you know, butt-kicking babyfaces as well. I mean, so I value versatility in my wrestlers. I don't know if, I can picture Power and Glory as baby faces. It's just that their time was up. We'd seen enough of Hercules at that point. Maybe Paul Roma could have been something, but it was enough with the Hercules thing. So Nasty Boys were the right choice here. They would drop the belts in a kind of quick tornado style whatever fight with the Legion of Doom at SummerSlam 1991, a card that I'm actually watching right now. Not right this second, I'm doing the podcast, but I was watching it the other day, and God, that's a really fun show from start to finish. But the Nasty Boys, are they potentially underrated in history? I'm not going to start making the Hall of Fame case for the Nasty Boys, although that would be one hell of a speech. But, I think that they should be appreciated by the wrestling fan public. Now it's time for the Funeral Parlor with Paul Bearer. And the Funeral Parlor was a segment that I always felt had a pretty good batting average relative to other talk shows in the past. You know, like your Blackjack's Barbecue, your Barber Shop, although, you know, there are a couple of barber shops that everybody remembers, but really most of them were forgettable. And then you had a long period of time where you just had the plain interview platform. And there were an awful lot of Piper's Pits. And only a few of them are fondly remembered. So the batting average there isn't so good. Funeral Parlor was only around for less than a year. It started after WrestleMania 7. This is the third Funeral Parlor. The first one was just Paul Bearer solo, kind of doing the, hey, how are you? You know, all that. Second one was Paul Bearer joined by The Undertaker, who made an open challenge to The Ultimate Warrior to come on the show the following week. As for the end, the Funeral Parlor's last edition was on February 29th, 1992 episode of Superstars. And that was one where Jake the Snake Roberts was the guest, and he gave Paul Bearer one of the best DDTs that I've ever seen, at least on a manager type, which he was able to do because The Undertaker's hand was locked in a coffin, just his hand, and he was able to drag the coffin around and chase after Jake. So it was a pretty good way for the Funeral Parlor to wrap up its brief run. Now, Paul Bearer had just come in about 2 months earlier, replacing Brother Love as the manager of The Undertaker, in what obviously I think was a good move, because the whole Brother Love and The Undertaker, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mentioned it in episode 5, where Brother Love was the manager of The Undertaker mainly because he didn't have any other wrestlers he was managing, so it kind of made The Undertaker stand out a little bit at the beginning. Now, before this, Paul Bearer, which is, of course, a great pun on the term Paul Bearer, those who carry a casket, Bill Moody was Percival Pringle III in World Class, which is also a great name and makes me really hungry for potato chips. The Ultimate Warrior, of course, was also in World Class, and I seem to recall from the ESPN show him having some sort of run-in with, I don't remember if he was, you know, working against Percival Pringle, but they were in the same place at the same time. Now, Bruce Pritchard talked about this on his podcast on the early Undertaker on Something to Wrestle With, and I'm going to confirm one of the things that he said, and that's that it's not easy to get a coffin. It's not like you can walk into the coffin store in a lot of places and say, yeah, I'd like this, you know, so you could, you know, set it up in your man cave or whatever. There are odd governmental regulations on that, usually along the lines of you need a death in order to get one. That's probably owes to the fact that they are airtight and you could, you know, do something to somebody with that, and there's really no need for a coffin unless you have someone who has died and you want to bury them. So, and of course, we all know that the WWF very much wanted to bury the Ultimate Warrior, but not yet, because we're only in April. We're not even to SummerSlam yet. So they pulled some strings because, of course, Bill Moody was a real mortician in real life, which is just one of the great happy coincidences in all of wrestling history. And we start out here, the Warrior comes out, and Paul Bearer is, "Oh, yes, you're scared, Ultimate Warrior, you're scared!" And, you know, he kind of repeats the point over and over again, as I'm dreading what the Warrior has to say, because I'm not sure I've ever enjoyed an Ultimate Warrior promo. They're all about the mystics and the gods and this and that and kind of hoo-ha. It didn't appeal to me at age 9 or 10, and it doesn't really appeal to me now. Yes, I feel bad that the guy, you know, died in 2014 the way that he did, but that's it just never really held much of an appeal for me. And let me just play what Warrior has to say, because I just... Paul Bearer makes reference to a look at his eye or whatever, and Warrior just kind of goes off on this odd whatever.
"You're scared? The bloodshot look in my eyes! Mr. Paul Bearer has been misinterpreted as the fear you know, but it only is the power that I now possess even more. For at WrestleMania 7, I questioned my destiny just for that one moment. And that God spoke to me and told me now was not the time to start that journey back to parts unknown. Now was not the time for my powers to cease. Now was not the time for me to be buried or covered by any sacred ground that you, Mr. Paul Bearer, or The Undertaker walk upon."
And no, Jim, no, this is not the time for you to be buried. We're going to wait until after you hold up Vince for money at SummerSlam 91. And then at that point, we'll bury you for a little while. Then we'll let you come back. Then we'll bury you for a few years. Then we'll let you come back. And then we'll bury you for about 18 years. So that's how it's probably going to go. Eventually, The Undertaker, who is standing in the upright coffin off to the side, says, "Enough of this hoo-ha." And just, it opens, and you got Vince, "Wait a minute!" And nails him with a couple of shots to the back. He hits him with the urn in the, quote, back of the head, although it was really more of back of the neck. Either way, is, you know, same thing. He picks him up, like in a body slam position, to put him in the coffin, because Paul Bearer has now opened the coffin. And Savage is very interesting here. As I said, he was more of a heel announcer at this point because he had just turned, and he's openly cheering this. He's like, "Come on, come on, Undertaker, I remember WrestleMania 7. Sorry, my voice is not in a good condition to do a proper Macho Man, but Savage is cheering for this. And he gets him into the coffin, but he has to keep pounding on him to kind of weaken him a bit. And the thing I can't ever take my eyes off of during this is how those friggin' tassels on the Warrior's legs keep sticking out of the coffin. And they've got to do a thing where the tassels are on the inside, so, you know, so that, you know, nothing is sticking out. It's like you don't want to have something, you know, your coat when you're driving sticking out your car door, you like where you close your door into it. So you got to get them all the way in. And he gets the Warrior all the way in, finally. So now I can begin the most comprehensive podcast breakdown of the Ultimate Warrior being locked in a coffin by The Undertaker and Paul Bearer. Now, the timestamps that I'm going to be giving here are that from the point where the coffin is closed and the Undertaker pushes down on it. Right at the beginning, you get Bearer off to the side doing that ceiling thing to make it extra tight. So in the video, it is approximately 31 minutes and 13 seconds when this happens. So he's in the coffin. Vince expresses concern over the situation, and nothing happens for a little while. And then at the 42nd mark, Tony Garea comes from the back and tries to open the freaking coffin with his bare hands like a moron. It's like, no wonder, Tony, no wonder why you've been just jobbing nonstop for the last 5 years of your career. They're not in very much of a hurry, like almost like they really don't want to get him out of there. And in fact, Bruce Pritchard confirmed this on that podcast where, yes, the agents did not like Ultimate Warrior at all. So there were some ribs and whatever played at this, you know, at this thing because of, you know, they could get in some free shots. 65 seconds, so minute five. Blackjack Lanza is out there, and he's there to do something, but he's really not doing much of anything. The announcers are starting to get a little worried here. And at a minute and 19 seconds, Earl Hebner, because Dave Hebner is the agent, merges with a crowbar, and it's at this point, at a minute 19, where Randy Savage thinks that he's gone too far. He was cheering for it, but too far. And I'm having trouble doing my Savage voice because I've had voice problems the last couple of weeks. But Savage, I've been to the danger zone a lot, but this is, you know, I've gone past the danger zone, but whatever. So Savage is starting to turn on this whole operation. Lanza gets the crowbar, and at a minute 45, he drops the crowbar, which in a way of like, well, crap, I give up, you know, I can't do anything here. Now, at the two-minute mark, here's Rene Goulet in his ridiculous hair coming out with a mallet and a pick. And then he starts to, you know, do the thing where he's trying to create maybe a hole of air between the top of the casket and, you know, to try and break the seal a little bit. But he hits it like one time very softly, then decides to take off his jacket. So clearly not in a hurry. Vince is getting a little more, you know, panicked on the commentary, yelling, "I gotta break the seal." So we're 2 minutes in here. By the way, Piper is giving out timestamps during this whole thing. And the timestamps that Piper is giving is way off at all times. First, he was underestimating it, and then he was overestimating it later. And that kind of gave me the idea to do a timestamp blow-by-blow here. 2 minutes and 35 seconds, they finally break out the power tools. But the problem is one of them, I think it was Lanza, shouts out, "Hey, does anybody have an extension cord?" And it's like, okay, all right, well, you guys don't have that sort of stuff backstage, you know. You don't have a battery-operated power drill. I'm pretty sure that those existed in 1991. As I said, Piper really screwed up on the time. At the 2 minute and 45 second mark, Piper says it's been a minute and 45. So the rare under-exaggeration in the world of wrestling. Like the time that on Nitro, Tony Schiavone said the Nitro crowd in Chicago was about 5,000 people less than it actually was. So a rare mistake from the WWF in that regard. 3 minutes and 5 seconds. They've got the drill, but the drill has failed because they can't go through the material. It's not a wood coffin, and they can't go through the material. So what Blackjack Lanza decides to do is just take the crowbar and start swinging at the side of it. And what Pritchard said is that this is the point where the agents were going to get their revenge on Warrior, and they were just going to beat the living hell out of that casket as he's sitting inside. So 3 minutes and 25, he's taking a swing. He's not doing the Joanna Cespedes swing for the fences thing here. He's kind of more taking a almost like a swinging bunt or an excuse me swing. But finally, after a bunch of them are hitting it with sledgehammers, and not the Triple H sledgehammer either, like, it just these really kind of weak shots. At 3 minutes and 46 seconds, per my accounting of this, the coffin has been opened, and the first thing you see is the Warrior lying there like he is deceased. and you see at the top of the coffin, the part that would have been right above his head, it's been all clawed out. So he was clawing at it on the inside, which is important for something that I'm going to get into in a second. But now, some background on the Ultimate Warrior that you may or may not have forgotten, because during his time away between 1996 and his Hall of Fame induction in 2014, he made a number of statements that really don't sit well with decent society, where he said something to the effect of queering doesn't make the world work, and made some other disparaging remarks about gays. And what happens next, okay, is they give him mouth to mouth, which of course is obviously a medical procedure. But of course, what it appears like is that Dave Hebner or Earl Hebner, I'm done trying to keep them straight, tries to perform mouth to mouth on him. So you got a man putting his lips on the Warrior, which I don't think they permitted Goldust to do in that 1996 feud there, and that was Ahmed Johnson. But so they got him in for the mouth to mouth, which I'm sure the Warrior just loved, and they're doing compressions on his chest. Now Vince on commentary, and this is pretty hilarious, he's asking, where is the professional help here? Now that's funny, because this is Vince McMahon here, the guy who got all the state athletic commission kicked out of the wrestling arenas, at least for his show. So if he hadn't have done that, in theory, if you think about it outside the confines of this kayfabe circus, if he doesn't get the state athletic commission doctors kicked out of the arena, they're there to provide the CPR and all that to revive the Warrior, and it would have happened a lot faster. So kind of ironic given what Vince is saying there. It's at this point now that Piper says it's been more than 5 minutes, or that he was in there for more than 5 minutes. As I said, it was really 3 minutes and 46 seconds, which coincidentally is longer than any match on the show here. So the longest thing on this show was Ultimate Warrior being locked in the coffin. And eventually they do get him out of there. Warrior kind of comes to and spits up a little bit like a baby, and they slowly walk him to the back. And the crowd was rather nonplussed about the whole thing. There was not a loud cheer when he got up, kind of, you know, the kind of cheer you would hear when a football player is down on the field and then he gets up and walks off the field under his own power. There was really none of that. I think it was so weird, and the angle was so weird and different, that I don't think they knew how to react at the Thomas and Mack Center in Las Vegas to something like this. So Warrior's in a coffin for 3:46. They obviously gimmicked it so that, you know, he could breathe on the inside and, you know, do whatever. But if you're wondering, there was a test done by a group called Brit Lab in 2016 of how long you could survive in a sealed coffin and, you know, not die. And the answer they came up with was 60 minutes. And the key to that is you have to not waste oxygen struggling to try and get out. So it's kind of one of those things where Warrior's panicked and trying to get out because he knows that the people who put him in are not going to be coming back to help him out. The guy in the test here knows that he can just lay there, and they took him out after 60 minutes. Because, you know, enough was enough there. He might have been able to go a little bit longer. Yes, they measured the oxygen levels of the casket. So my advice to you, my official Greetings from Allentown podcast advice, if you ever find yourself locked in a coffin, don't struggle too much, because that's just going to waste oxygen. And in this case, I think the Ultimate Warrior was just gassed anyway, so he was probably using up all the oxygen at one time, so maybe it could have been an emergency situation after 3 minutes and 46 seconds. There's another oddity about this entire thing. And of course, it's always creepy to people about the way the Warrior died in 2014, and then viewing this angle in retrospect and, you know, tying that all together. This, of course, was taped on March 26, 1991, which was 2 days after WrestleMania 7. And the Warrior passed away in a parking lot of a heart attack 2 days after WrestleMania 30. So that, I think that's particularly creepy. And this whole angle, of course, obviously extremely memorable. Otherwise, I would not be doing this. And it was probably the last Great Ultimate Warrior angle, because the stuff when he came in his two comebacks weren't all that great. Yeah, the Macho Man match at SummerSlam 92 was okay, but after that first time where he left, I don't think it was really the same. But it was a good angle in that the series of matches served to elevate The Undertaker, who was protected because they made it body bag matches and all that, so that he's never taking a pin. And you can't argue with anything really that they did with The Undertaker early on, because it propelled him to a high level, and he's literally was still there as of a month or two ago at WrestleMania, still active. And of course now he's apparently retired, but this kind of set him on his course. He's becomes a world champion before the end of the year. So I have no problem with locking a guy in a coffin as part of the angle. Yeah, it's a little over the top and cartoonish, but it's good material for the show, and that's all I care about. That was some heavy stuff. So usually you want to have a palate cleanser after something like that. And who's a better palate cleanser than good old Tugboat? Uncle Fred Ottman taking on the Brooklyn Brawler, Steve Lombardi. And Tugboat was definitely a nowhere man at this time. And he comes in 1990, and I remember seeing him for the first time and just thinking, What the hell is this? Why is he wearing this ridiculous Sailor Man outfit? Is he supposed to be emblematic of a boat? Is he like a first mate on a boat? Like, what is the deal? You finally take the opportunity to make him the first mate, if you will, to Hogan. When Hogan gets attacked by Earthquake, they have Tugboat urge people to write letters, which of course is to increase the WWF catalog mailing list, which they always use that sort of stuff for. But all of a sudden, Tugboat, who was supposed to be in Hulk Hogan's corner at SummerSlam 1990, is off the show at the last minute after being attacked by Earthquake about a week or so before SummerSlam 1990. And that's always been the subject of speculation, why Tugboat was taken off that show. I've read that it was a disciplinary thing. I don't think it was anything to do with drugs or anything. He was clearly not on steroids, at least to me. I think he was taken off because, and this is where I've read this in a couple of places, so at least, you know, a couple of sources. I don't know the veracity of them, but Tugboat was getting a big head about the level of his push at the time that he came in. Cut to the Survivor Series. He's on Hogan's team, and he's barely in the match. I don't know if he was suffering from an injury, but he was kind of standing on the apron, and I think commentary said something to the effect of, they're saving Tugboat for the end, which is just hilarious. Like, whoa, Tugboat is Zach Britton or something? We're saving him for the ninth inning? I mean, come on, give me a break. He's also in the Royal Rumble, and he's actually number 30, so that kind of makes him stand out, but he's more a Warlord, Duke the Dumpster Drosy kind of number 30, rather than a John Cena in 2008 number 30. He's out in 2 minutes and 32 seconds, and the only thing that was memorable about Tugboat's 1991 Royal Rumble performance was he went at Hulk Hogan straight on, and that was surprising given the friendship that the two had. Now, Bruce Pritchard and I hate to keep referencing his podcast, but he had mentioned something, I believe it was during his WrestleMania 7 show, that an idea was discussed to make Tugboat the Sergeant Slaughter-style heel and make him the Iraqi sympathizer, called Sheik Tugboat. Now, I cannot believe that that would have been serious for even one second. I really, I just don't buy it that it came. It may have been written down on a bar napkin, but I don't think it was written down on like a legal pad or anything formal. So probably not worth even talking about it. And speaking of not talking, I haven't mentioned anything about this match. And that's fine, because Vince and Roddy and Macho Man, they don't really give a rat's ass what's going on in the ring either, because they're just talking about what happened on the funeral parlor. And that's why you throw out a guy like Tugboat, or back earlier in the 80s, you'd throw out the Killer Bees after a segment. You know, somebody that nobody really cares, you know, what happens to them or whatever. Tugboat just no-sells everything here. You got Lombardi. Lombardi's no threat to really body slam him or anything. Tugboat wins with the big splash, which Big E kind of does that in WWE now, where he kind of runs both ropes and then kind of jumps really high in the air for the splash. And that usually looks good if you have a guy in the mid 300 pounds doing something like that. Nothing really to see here, because you get the Tugboat heel turn that's incoming very soon, where he would join Earthquake and form the Natural Disasters. And you could tell how far Tugboat had fallen, because they didn't give him the heel turn on Hulk Hogan. They're not gonna waste Hogan's time by having a Tugboat heel turn. He turned heel on the Bushwhackers. So they were kind of a sacrificial lamb there to create the Natural Disasters team. And they went on to have a bunch of success going forward, winning the tag team titles in 1992. Coming up now, we have an IRS vignette, and IRS was about to debut. He had just jumped over from WCW, where he was Michael Wall Street, a coincidentally very similar character to what he would play as IRS, except more of a Wall Street trader type instead of a IRS agent. And Vince McMahon had to have been audited in 1990 by the IRS. There's no question about it. He's so, like, why would you come up with this character now? Maybe it was the tax hike that was passed by Congress in 1990, and Vince wasn't happy about that. So we get IRS, Mike Rotundo, back, and he had a much longer run as IRS and much more successful than anybody could have possibly imagined, given the utter silliness of the gimmick. He says that late filers are nothing but con men. Now, I looked this up. I did the research on it. And there are 5% of taxpayers, about 5% of taxpayers, fail to file their taxes by the deadline without getting a proper extension, which is 7 million. So it is fairly substantial, but he is addressing approximately 1 in 20 people in the audience. And the WWF had a large audience of children. So as a kid, I just remember thinking, I don't really care about the IRS. You have an 8-year-old or 9-year-old kid watching this. How are they going to react to IRS? They really, oh, he's mean. He's going to audit mommy and dad. I don't know what they were supposed to do. So why don't I just play the whole clip of the IRS vignette right now?
Hello, I'm Irwin R. Scheister with more of my 17 reasons why you should file your tax return on time. Reason 13, if you're late, I'll come after you. Reason 14, if I come after you, it'll be like the lying, cheating criminal that you are. Because to me, late filers are nothing more than con men trying to swindle the U.S. government. And the same goes for all of you who plan to claim more than 2% of your gross income as deductible, or those who'll try to sneak a few business deductions through without fully itemized receipts. You can just forget about it. And forget about finding some kind of tax loophole, too. Because if I get wind you're trying to do that, I'll see to it that that loophole gets tightened right around your neck.
If all the auditors with the Internal Revenue Service had the same demeanor as Irwin R. Scheister, I'm sure they could collect enough to clear the national debts.
Now, that wasn't a mistake. I wanted to leave in the Sean Mooney bit because, see, as I was saying before, Mooney very underrated with those quips when they cut to him. And, you know, they didn't throw it to him. They just went to straight to the event center where they're promoting no event. And you get two interviews here. We get Bobby Heenan with Haku, which Haku, definitely not much of a talker at any point in his career, but I still am afraid of him, I think. And they mentioned that he was back from a successful tour of Japan, which was true. He was loaned out to the SWS promotion, and definitely Haku, the kind of guy who could work Japan and be successful there, working a lot of tag matches there. And you had the Big Boss Man cutting a generic promo against the Mountie and refers to him as a Canadian law enforcement officer, which of course would become a real bugaboo with the actual Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who would not allow Jacques Rougeau to portray the Mountie character or to be called as such in Canada or on Canadian television. Bossman just kind of moves closer towards the camera during the promo, which kind of weirds me out, but also kind of makes me miss that sort of thing. You know, now what you have is guys staring off into the distance and not addressing the camera, and then when they walk away, you have the interviewer stare off into space like freaking morons. Piper and the rest of the gang, actually Piper is not there when they cut back to the broadcast position, and Piper had gone to the back to sort of check on the Ultimate Warrior as if he really cared all that much. And he says that, you know, he's struggling back there and this and that kind of stuff. And that is how they wrap up the show. But we're not done here, because this is a video that has been on YouTube for quite a while. It's from a very different uploader by the name of Stone Cold 619, which kind of, I guess, combining Rey Mysterio's finisher with, you know, the Austin 316. So now it is time for YouTube Comment Theater. Now, there are a lot of comments on this video, a lot more than what we usually have. The last couple weeks couldn't do this segment because there were no real comments to speak of. One of them I had to upload myself, so nothing there. Here you had 212 comments for me to mine through. And we'll start with Austin O'Mara. Kind of creepy seeing the Warrior in a casket, and bittersweet seeing the Macho Man standing next to Roddy Piper. And yeah, 1991 WWF has a lot of dead people on the show, not to mention, you know, the Big Boss Man, who recently would have turned, I believe, only 57 or 53 years old if he had lived just the other day. Jack Clegg says, love when Piper said, Warrior was in the casket almost a minute when it was actually 2 minutes by that time. This and Earthquake putting Hulk out of commission gave me nightmares back in those days. Well, my nightmare fuel when I was a kid was more when Andre the Giant would come out. Especially that time when he came out in the odd checkered suit and choked the hell out of Hulk Hogan on Saturday Night's Main Event with that maniacal look on his face. That was kind of nightmare fuel for me as a kid. And that was happened before I was even watching, so I would just sort of, you know, see it later on. STNDRDS79, so let's just call him Standard 79, has a controversial comment here. Brett was always a mid-card wrestler. He doesn't understand his place in wrestling history and is not as great as he thinks. And a lot of people took this guy to task for that, and I agree with that. I disagree with the notion that Bret Hart was not good. Pre-Apocalypse Jitters says, Warrior trapped in the coffin, Gorilla, Lanza, Hebner, Goulet, using fly swatters to pry it open. McMahon screaming, when's the professional help gonna get here? Best show in town. And we'll wrap it up with Mark Rushing, who, this has to be tongue-in-cheek, but it's great. Hey, CJ90, I am talking about how Vince McMahon, WWE owner, could stoop so effing low to order The Undertaker to do satanic damage to another human being by locking him in a real casket for 5 minutes or more. That was real. Did you not read my last statement carefully? And again, that was attempted murder. No acting. No acting is all in caps. So got a little heated there in the YouTube comments this week. And that'll wrap it up for this episode of Superstars. And as for next week's show, I'm going to make it a little bit of a departure from what I've done in previous weeks. This coming up episode, lucky number 13. I'm not entirely sure which episode I want to do next. Probably be another WWF episode. As I was doing the recording for this episode, I saw more Richard Land uploads. One for November 26, 1988 episode of Superstars, where Bad News Brown threatens Jack Tunney on the Brother Love show. That's a good one. I'm also planning a show on the Bruno Sammartino, Larry Zbyszko saga as it played out, centered around the episode of Championship Wrestling where Bruno and Larry finally had their match. There are a few others that I have. There's one from 1994 from the Lowell Memorial Auditorium that I'd like to do coming up, where Chief J. Strongbow gets the crap beat out of him by IRS because it was so enjoyable. But I think a little bit of IRS goes a long way. So we just did an IRS thing. So I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to do for next week. But stay tuned to the Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, and I will definitely have something up, as I usually do. Usually around Monday, I'll start putting up screen caps of whatever episode we got coming up with a little bit of a description. So follow me on there. Follow me on, or rate and review on, I guess it's not iTunes anymore. I've found that out since I recorded the opening bit, and I'm not going to go back and change it because it doesn't really matter, because people are going to be calling it iTunes anyway, and they may end up changing it back from the Apple Music Store or whatever the hell they changed it to. It's kind of like how people were calling them the Oakland Raiders by accident for almost the entire time that they were in Los Angeles, to the point where, you know, 12 years later they're back in Oakland anyway. So it's, you know, like nothing happened. But yes, follow the show on iTunes, Apple Store, whatever they're calling it, or on SoundCloud. Like, rate, and review. All that stuff is greatly appreciated. And stay tuned and tune in next week for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.